Hello and welcome. You're tuned into the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, hard-hitting journalist Dave Schrader. Along with me, the barrister of brawn, Mr. Tim Dennis. How do you like that, Tim?
That's my new wrestling name.
Yep, barrister of brawn.
Yeah.
Yeah. Listen, I'm psyched about today's episode. We talked about this last week on Thursday's show that we locked in a great guest for this week. He is one of our favorites by far, and this is a topic that intrigues both Tim and I for many reasons. When we find a true crime story that I want to dig into, but I can't find anybody alive that's willing to talk about it or is willing to just, you know, talk about it outside of what they've written, there's only one guy we could turn to. And that is, of course, our good friend Mark Anthony. And Mark, of course, being an attorney, a lawyer, and having worked in the law system for many years, from both sides, knows these cases and is so good at researching and digging deep. And there's been a case that has fascinated me. As a huge fan of Frank Sinatra since I was a kid, I love all things Frank, and I got a chance to see Frank Sinatra in concert a few times. As a matter of fact, Tim and I think we saw his final concert tour.
We did, 1992.
Yeah, just before he passed away a few years later, but I think that was his final tour. And then after Frank Sr. died, Frank Jr. came to town, and Tim and I went, and we got to meet Frank Jr., and there's a picture of Frank between Tim and I, and he looks very much like he's terrified he's going to end up in our trunk, tied up and gagged. And maybe that's because he had lived through an abduction before. Yep. He had been kidnapped, and there's a lot of speculation, a lot of strange stories surrounding that case. So there's only one bloodhound I want on the case. That's Mark Anthony. Mark, thanks for being here with us again, my friend.
Thank you, Dave, and thank you, Tim. It's always great being back with you guys. And let me tell you something, Dave. When you gave me this case, I was like, yeah, this has every element of a macabre, a twisty, turny. I mean, this could be an entire miniseries.
Well, that's what I loved about it. It was just such everything I've read about it for years. There are different articles that contradict each other and things that go into different angles of the story. And I'm like, what is the actual truth of this? And it seems so convoluted. I didn't know if we'd ever get to an actual truth. So let's see what you were able to uncover digging through the archives of the Sinatra family files. Talk to us and give us some of the history of the kidnapping, if you wouldn't mind.
Well, I don't think there's anybody that knows anything about music who hasn't heard of Frank Sinatra, Old Blue Eyes. And like you guys said, you saw one of his last concerts, which is just fantastic. And in the early 1960s, his son, Frank Sinatra Jr., wanted to follow in his father's footsteps and be another crooner. Now, let's go back in time to 1963. Frank Sinatra was known as the chairman of the board, the head of the so-called Rat Pack. And that included not only Frank Sinatra, but Dean Martin, Joey Bishop, Sammy Davis Jr., Peter Lawford, Shirley MacLaine was part of it. Marilyn Monroe sort of was wafting on the periphery. This was the golden age of Las Vegas and casinos. And Frank Sinatra owned the Cal Neva Casino. Now, that's Lake Tahoe. In Nevada. And Lake Tahoe, if you're looking at it north to south, it's sort of kind of oval shaped. And at the north end of it is the Cal Neva Casino. On the south end of it is the Hara Lake Tahoe resort. And what's cool about both Cal Neva and the Harrah's Club Lake Tahoe is the California-Nevada line runs right through both the hotel, I mean, both casinos. So on the California side is all the hotel rooms. On the Nevada side is the casino. And I've been to the Cal Neva, and I've done some research there and got to walk around. And it's cool because there's this line that goes right through the center of the casino, and it says California, then Nevada. And the very second you step into Nevada, slot machines, roulette tables, etc. All right, so back in this time, there was a down-and-out loser. His name is Barry Keenan, 23-year-old, unsuccessful, failed stockbroker, already been divorced, abusing pain medication. But he was friends with Dean Torrance of the early 60s surfer music pop group Jan and Dean. And Jan and Dean were on the way up. And what's really fascinating, they were high school friends. So Jan and Dean are also friends with Barry Keenan. And the interesting thing about Dean is that he was going to USC, University of Southern California, but still living at home with his mom. So here he is, a rock star, going to college, living with mom. And one day, Barry Keenan swings by his house and says, I need $1,200. And Dean Torrance is like, well, you know, you're a friend of mine and you're down and out. And Keenan tells him that he's got a plan, a plot to kidnap none other than Frank Sinatra Jr. and then get the ransom money. And he said, well, I'll do some good with the ransom money and I'll invest it and eventually I'll even pay it back. And had all these crazy theories that he told Dean Torrance. And you know what, Dave? Dean actually gave him the $1,200.
Wait, what?
Yeah, he did. Okay, so, you know, if a friend of yours comes to you and says, you know, I'm going to kidnap, you know, Donald Trump Jr. I mean, because seriously, in 1963, that's how famous the Sinatras were. Okay, would you give that person money? Heck no, but Dean Torrance did. So then Barry Keenan enlists the help of his friend Joe Amsler, also 23, and another high school friend. And so they start stalking Frank Sinatra Jr. They start monitoring his movements for a couple weeks between L.A., Bel Air, Reno, Lake Tahoe. Then December 23rd, 1963, President John F. Kennedy is assassinated. The main suspect is Lee Harvey Oswald. And while Lee Harvey Oswald is being held at the Dallas Police Department, Jack Ruby walks in to the Dallas Police Department armed and shoots Lee Harvey Oswald, killing him. So the whole country is in complete disarray. People are shocked and horrified. President Kennedy was assassinated. It hit, obviously, world news. People were absolutely devastated. Then his killer is executed 2 days later. And then on December 8th, 1963, Frank Sinatra Jr. is relaxing, getting ready for a show at Harris Club Lake Tahoe. There's a knock on the door that there's a package to be delivered to him, and it's actually Barry Keenan and Joe Amsler, and they abduct him at gunpoint. They tied up his friend, put tape over his mouth, stick Frank Sinatra Jr. in the trunk of their car, and drive off. Okay, so Sinatra's friend frees himself, calls the police. Immediately, Frank Sinatra, old Blue Eyes himself, is in Reno at the Mapes Hotel. As soon as Frank Sinatra Jr. hears this, he calls Attorney General Robert Kennedy. Bobby Kennedy is still on the job as Attorney General. The next call that Frank Sr. makes was to FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover. Within 40 minutes, the FBI is alerted from Nevada through California. They're at the Sinatra's home. They're all over the place. Now, let's take a step back for a second. Let's talk about the Calneva Hotel, just on the other side of Lake Tahoe.
Right. Now, this was his pride and joy, right? I mean, Sinatra, being such a big figure in Vegas, had wanted for a long time to kind of cut his way into casino life.
He sure did. And the Calneva was a hot spot. I mean, we're talking the Rat Pack was there, Lucille Ball. I mean, anybody who was everybody in Hollywood, they, you know, because they were all friends of Frank, friends and a little bit intimidated or a lot intimidated by Frank. But there was a darker side to the Calneva. It was frequented by mob boss Sam Giancana. And there's also allegations that JFK, President Kennedy, and Robert Kennedy had also been visitors there, which insinuates a link to Marilyn Monroe, who was also a guest at the Calneva. And you know what? When Marilyn was staying at the Calneva, she actually overdosed on some pills and had to be rushed to the hospital. So there's this whole epicenter of Hollywood and mob activity on one end of Lake Tahoe. And it's speculated that it wasn't just Bobby Kennedy and J. Edgar Hoover that that old Blue Eyes called.
So he goes above and beyond the normal routes of trying to find his son, because again, he's a parent in a panicky mode, right?
Well, and yeah, exactly. I mean, any parent's going to pull out the stops. And when you're Frank Sinatra and you got, you know, the best contacts, legal and otherwise, in the world, and your son's missing. So meanwhile, Keenan and Amsler had enlisted the help of John Irwin. Now, he's quite a bit older than them. He's 42 years old. He used to date Keenan's mother some years before. And they take him to the safe house, which is in California. Now, here's one of the anomalies. While on the way out of Lake Tahoe, there was a police roadblock. And while at the police roadblock, it stopped the car that Keenan and Amsler were driving, and Frank Jr. is in the trunk. And Frank Jr. never cried out. Now, granted, he was, you know, he was gagged and blindfolded. And there's a lot of speculation. Why didn't he cry out? You know, was there something going on here, or was he afraid they were going to kill him? At any rate, eventually, Amsler and Keenan get to California, and they leave Frank Jr. with John Irwin. And John Irwin, even though Frank Sinatra Jr. is all tied up and gagged and blindfolded, takes the gag off, talks to him. Young Sinatra is very uncooperative, doesn't want to say how to get hold of his dad. But eventually, Irwin makes the call to Frank Sinatra. Meanwhile, J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI are on the case, and they said, take the call, come up with the money, give them the money. They left a suitcase full of money between two school buses in Sepulveda, California, which is right outside of L.A. Well, meanwhile, Irwin is so nervous about, oh, my God, we've got Frank Sinatra Jr. He lets him go. Actually lets him go. And Frank's walking down the street and hails down a cop who then sticks Frank again in the trunk of the cop car so that the media won't see him and drives him to his mother's house. All right. So young Frank Sinatra has been rescued, has been returned within days. John Irwin's picked up. Joe Amsler is picked up with almost 170 grand. Barry Keenan's picked up right on the Mexican border with about $60,000-$70,000. So most of the money's recovered. Irwin's the first to crack, confesses, you know, that this was a plot that was masterminded by Barry Keenan. So now comes the trial. And you know what's really interesting about this, Dave and Tim? In my work as an attorney, both as a prosecutor and a criminal defense lawyer, it takes months for a complex and a high-profile case to go to trial. This case went to trial, at least the charges against Barry Keenan, within 2 months.
And that's really rare.
That's warp speed in the legal system. A kidnapping of a major celebrity, the defendant goes to trial within 2 months. So it's in February of 1963. Frank Jr. is now 20 years old, and this trial was a circus. First off, you have the prosecutor.
Hand-picked. Can I ask real quickly, do you think that the reason it kind of sped through was on purpose so that they could show, you know, this kind of protective aspect for celebrities? Hey, if you do this, your justice is going to be swift and harsh. And this is kind of the concept. So they're relaying to other ne'er-do-wells that might be considering doing the same thing.
Absolutely. And plus, we're also dealing with the wake of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. That rocked America's world. People were terrified. If the president wasn't safe, is anybody safe? And so now they're coming down all the big guns to bear right on Barry Keenan. And so Bobby
now,
Kennedy.
Now, can I ask though real quickly, they know what's happened, what are the theories that are being bandied about? Does Frank think it's mob ties? Because I know that he had used his connections allegedly to help get JFK into office. when JFK took over and he and Bobby kind of waged this war against the mob, there was a lot of animosity. And that put Sinatra under the speculative microscope of the mob for his involvement in this, and that he wasn't able to follow up with any of the promises that Kennedy had made to him. So I was wondering if there was any speculation or fear on Frank's part that this was a mob hit or a mob kidnapping, or did he have any aspect or idea of who might be doing this?
Well, right off the bat, and the reason I was trying to get into the attorney's work, and I'm going to answer your question. Okay, you had Thomas Sheridan. He's a 34-year-old ruthless prosecutor handpicked by Bobby Kennedy. Then there were the defense team. George Ford, who came right out and said, this is a stunt and a hoax, and if this was a kidnapping, I'll be next on the moonshot. And the most flamboyant attorney of the time, Gladys Towles Root. I mean, first off, she's a female in an extremely male-dominated legal profession. She's known for wearing flashy furs, gaudy jewelry, outrageous outfits. And she claimed that this was a contract between Frank Sinatra and the mob to raise the profile of young Frank Sinatra and make him a big star. So right out of the box, Dave, you're absolutely right. Those are the allegations that are flooding. The media is just biting like sharks. And it doesn't help that Dorothy Kilgallen, the so-called voice of Broadway, gossip columnist, she had it out for Frank Sinatra, didn't like him, didn't like JFK. In fact, Dorothy Kilgallen, there's a lot of, a lot of controversy in her wake. In 1962, she broke a story about the liaison between JFK and Marilyn Monroe, and then Marilyn's found dead just a few days later. Also, she interviewed Jack Ruby and announced she was going to break the Kennedy case wide open. So we'll get to her in a bit later.
Okay.
Now, what you're saying about Sinatra and the mob, what happened was Sinatra and the mob were definitely rooting for the Kennedys. And it is alleged that Chicago went for Kennedy and they just won it by a narrow margin simply because of San Giancana and part of what they called the Syndicate, which was a cooperation of the mob families all the way from New York to San Francisco and L.A. And then Robert Kennedy, the attorney general, younger brother of President John F. Kennedy, turns on the mob. Interesting. So in mafia circles, it appeared that the Kennedys bit the hand that fed. In fact, the mob boss of New Orleans, his name is Carlos Marcello. Right after JFK, right after President John F. Kennedy was assassinated, Bobby Kennedy was overheard saying, and I believe that Dorothy Kilgallen went ahead and reported this. Bobby Kennedy said, I'm the one they wanted. And in response to that, Carlos Marcello, head of New Orleans Mafia, said, well, the president was the dog. The attorney general was its tail. If you cut off the tail, the dog will keep biting. But if you chop off the head, the dog will die, tail and all.
It's a little insidious.
You think?
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is like all swirling around. Now, back to the trial. So, it was like like I said, it was a circus. Barry Keenan never took the witness stand, which was probably a good thing. But the thing is, attention immediately went to Dean Torrance because it got around that right after the kidnapping, 3 days after the kidnapping, Barry Keenan gave Dean Torrance something like $25,000. He said, well, I'm repaying you. And Torrance is like, what? And he left it in the shower of Dean Torrance's house. And then had breakfast with Dean of Jan and Dean and his mother. Okay. Also, it was discovered that both Dean Torrance and Barry Keenan shared a safety deposit box. which is really stupid if you're going to be involved in a kidnapping and you're trying to hide money and things. FBI zeroes in on that. They get Torrance to open it up, and they find a letter inside the safety deposit box, which was written by Keenan, which essentially said, if anyone finds this, I'm either in prison or dead. And I meant to do this, and this was all my plan, but I was going to do some good with the money. And I'm sorry, but that letter alone being admitted into evidence should have had the case over with. But the defense attorneys, the very flamboyant Gladys Towles Root and George Ford, put Frank Sinatra Jr. on trial. Now, a lot of people ask, well, that sounds really terrible. The thing is, though, Dave, it's a very typical defense tactic. Change the narrative. The cross-examination, why didn't you cry out at the roadblock? Why didn't you try to escape? How can you say you're a victim? And Frank Jr. said to the press, it's a mark on my integrity and guts that will stay with me for the rest of my life. So Gladys Towles Root kept saying this was a hoax. It was a publicity stunt. The young Sinatra kept saying, well, Keenan was unstable and he has had a gun. And then the rock star takes the stand. Dean Torrance is called by it. U.S. Attorney General, Assistant Attorney General Thomas Sheridan puts him on the witness stand. Grueling examination. First half of the morning, it's September 24th, 1963, and Dean Torrance denies any knowledge of involvement with the kidnapping. But he does admit that he loaned his good friend, Barry Keenan, $1,200. There's a lunch break. Dean Torrance comes back after lunch, does a 180-degree about, takes the witness stand, admits he's committed perjury, knew about the kidnapping, knew about everything, said that Barry Keenan told him about the plot. He loaned him the money. Boom. The jury is out for like 30 minutes, comes back guilty on all counts.
Now, why? Okay, he's perjured himself by doing this. He loans the money. During cross-examination, they've got to ask him why.
Here's what he said. I just thought it was a story. Not many people go around and kidnap Frank Sinatra Jr. It all seemed like a story. When it comes up to you and someone says what they're going to do, you don't really believe it. That was his response.
Right, to a degree. But, you know, if you're borrowing money from me and I want a concept of, you know, so you're going to borrow this, what are you going to pay me back? What's it for? You know, when somebody's answer is, I'm going to kidnap Frank Sinatra Jr., we're going to ask for X amount of dollars, and then I'm going to use it at this and use it at that. What?
Well, and it gets even more bizarre, because when Dean Torrance gave Barry Keenan the money, he was with a friend of his, a guy named Dennis Gray. And so Teresa Gray is the wife of Dennis Gray, and both the Grays were called to the witness stand. And this is how unsophisticated this plot was. Teresa Gray said she comes home one day and there is Barry Keenan and Joe Amsler playing with piles of cash in her living room. And they asked, hey, do you have a Monopoly game board so we can play Monopoly with real money? I mean, if you're going to commit a kidnapping of somebody as high profile as that, and then you go around like it's a big joke. And so Teresa Gray said, well, no, we don't have a Monopoly game. And her husband was so unnerved by this, he even contemplated suicide.
Now, once Dean has heard that the abduction took place, does he ever step forward to call the police and say, hey, I might have a tip for you or I might know something?
Not at all. He did cooperate in that when the FBI showed up, he did take them to the safety deposit box and he did open it. But then when he took the witness stand, he lied denied all involvement. But then something happened at lunch and it's very unclear exactly what happened. It seems like he had a change of heart. He came back and he told the judge, everything I've done, I lied and I want to come clean. I think what happened, the prosecutors probably got hold of him and said, look, we know and maybe they had something or maybe they didn't, but I think they put the fear of J. Edgar Hoover into him. And they said that, we know that you did this, and we're going to have you up on perjury. And even the judge said, you know, we're going to have to turn this over to the attorney general's office to, you know, to investigate Dean Torrence for perjury. Nothing ever came of that, at least in court.
Okay. Why do you think that is? I mean, that is a weird aspect. I'd never heard of this story.
Yeah, that was very weird. Although both the attorneys, George Floyd and Gladys Towles Root, were prosecuted by Thomas Sheridan for suborning perjury. Now, that's highly unusual to go after the defense attorneys in a case that you won, put them on trial. Now, both Ford and Root got out of it, but it caused them a huge amount of aggravation. And then Amsler and Irwin's trials came very soon after that. All of them were convicted. All of them were sentenced to life in prison. All of them appealed, and all of them were out in under 5 years. In fact, Barry Keenan's still alive, and he's a successful businessman, probably retired now, in Los Angeles.
Okay.
I know. So this is twisted. Yeah, I mean, this is like Hollywood, Las Vegas, Lake Tahoe. I mean, everything just gone completely, completely haywire. However, one doesn't cross old blue eyes. And meanwhile, Dorothy Killigan, Kilgallen.
Right.
Yeah, Dorothy Kilgallen is on the case, and she's tracking everything that happens, because Jan and Dean's career took a turn for the worst right after this. All of a sudden, they were trying to sell a TV pilot, Surf Scene. Well, that didn't sell. Next, they were cut from the movie Ride the Wild Surf. This is in the early 60s. They're making all those movies with Fabian and Annette Funicello, all these goofy surf movies. But the thing is, though, their record sales boomed. So the notoriety helped with their record sales. In fact, Jan and Dean, they sang the title track still for Ride the Wild Surf and two of their other songs, and we've all heard them, Dead Man's Curve and The Little Old Lady from Pasadena. That's Jan and Dean. But the problem is their success didn't last very long, because in 1965, they were about to film another movie, and Jan Berry, who had nothing to do with the kidnapping, but he got seriously injured in a train accident on set. So he recovered by 1966, but the film was canceled. And then, Dave, and this is real suspicious, once Jan recovered, they had another TV show looming. Okay, so another TV show is in the works. And Jan Berry, he's a hot rodder, and he's driving his 1966 Corvette, and he's in a horrible car accident. He's in a coma for a month, suffered brain damage, partial paralysis that lasted the rest of his life. Kilgallen starts circulating, was this an attempted hit on Dean Torrence? Was Jan Berry wrongly targeted? Could someone possibly think that Dean might be driving Jan's Corvette? And then the Corvette that he had something called knockoff wheels. And this is very interesting, researching this. They've been illegal since 1970, but knockoff wheels were apparently a feature on the hot rod sports cars of the day, and they're designed to tighten as they rotate. The driver's side wheel rotates counterclockwise as the car is driven. The knockoff spinner is a right hand threaded, so it tightens as the car rolls forward. The passenger side wheel rotates clockwise as the car is driven. I mean, it's just like, what? Okay, so it's got this really bizarre system with the wheels, and there's speculation that the wheels came off the car, and that's why Jan was in such a horrible accident.
So there's a lot of twists and all of this, again, kind of stemming from, is this payback for for what happened?
Well, Dorothy Kilgallen definitely had a vendetta of her own against Frank Sinatra Jr. She was the first journalist to report in 1959 that the CIA and the mafia were in collusion and plotting to assassinate Cuban dictator Fidel Castro. So when that happened, that brought her on J. Edgar Hoover's radar screen. Not a good place to be.
No. Okay.
And so J. Edgar Hoover started having her watched and started keeping a file on her. Then in 62, like we mentioned earlier, Kilgallen broke the story about JFK's illicit affair with Marilyn Monroe. And just a few days after that, Marilyn Monroe was found dead. Now, there's a lot of speculation on this. And I even have some insights. I did a reading once, Dave. And for the listeners who aren't aware of my background, I am a psychic medium. I'd say I'm fairly well known. I actually did a reading for Shirley MacLaine once. And lo and behold, during the session, the spirit of Marilyn Monroe came through. And Shirley said, did she die by her own hand or was she murdered? And the impression that I got from Marilyn was that she did die by her own hand. She was very depressed, and it seemed that she simply succumbed to her addictions. So I'm putting that in for my perspective. But there's a lot of people that think that either the mafia or the FBI did away with her because they didn't want the president's reputation being tainted.
That's crazy. But Dorothy Kilgallen, I mean, what is her attitude with the Sinatra family and doing this? Or was it really, you know, no real vendetta, but just the fact that it sold papers and she was a reporter and salacious, you know, if it bleeds, it leads kind of headlines were what was the way to go at that time?
Well, she started circulating that Frank Sinatra was the one who was destroying Jan and Dean's career. She said that in social circles, not in print, that nobody F's with Sinatra. Okay. And, you know, I'm keeping it G-rated here. I think everyone can fill in that blank. And that Sinatra, she described him as having tentacles which stretched into every facet of the entertainment business, whether it's TV, movies, music, whatever. If you cross Frank Sinatra, that's the kiss of death, you know, literally and figuratively. And then Kilgallen, after JFK's assassination, she said, I'm going to break this case wide open. So she started doing intensive research. And in many ways, she may be the first modern investigative journalist. And we hear a lot about investigative journalists. And supposedly, or a lot of people knew that she had a very in-depth file. She was keeping files. And so earlier when I said that Jack Ruby assassinated or murdered Lee Harvey Oswald 2 days after Lee Harvey Oswald was accused of of shooting President Kennedy. Well, Kilgallen was able to interview Jack Ruby twice. So she got into the prison where he was being held, and she interviewed him. And what she found out, she said that according to her, it wasn't just the mob that had a problem with the Kennedys. The Havana anti-Castro Cubans had lost their big profit center when Cuba went communist. The CIA despised Kennedy, feeling he'd botched the Bay of Pigs. And then in a few weeks before Kilgallen was found dead, she was found dead at the age of 52 under mysterious circumstances, but she was in New Orleans. And it was believed that she was investigating Carlos Marcello, the head of the New Orleans family. Here's a fascinating tidbit. Not long before JFK's assassination, both Lee Harvey Oswald and Jack Ruby were in New Orleans. And it is believed that they both met with Carlos Marcello on a couple different occasions. And the night before Kilgallen was found dead, she met with a mystery man whose identity's never been revealed. And the next morning, November 8th, her dead body was found in a way that many people consider was very staged. She wasn't wearing her usual pajamas. She was wearing a negligee, full makeup, false eyelashes, this hairpiece. And on the bedstand were two glasses with a residue of vodka and Nebutal, which was her sleeping pill of choice. But there was something else that the toxicology report indicated was Tuinol. And Tuinol is a barbiturate that she never used. It's a powder. And none of her friends, none of her associates said, no, she never did that. And then in the wake of her death, it appears that very sloppy police work was done, or was very sloppy police work done on purpose. So the police department, medical examiner, coroners, toxicologists all concluded it must have been an accidental overdose. Book is closed. Or was it?
Mm. So now, do you think, kind of reviewing this aspect, is it because she was getting too close to uncovering the Kennedy assassination? Was this allegedly payback for her attacks on Frank Sinatra and Frank Sinatra Jr.?
Very, very possibly, because not only was she going after the Sinatras, she was making things very uncomfortable for Carlos Marcella, Sam Giancana, other figures. I think Trafficante, she mentioned. And here's the thing. In 2017, Dave, the FBI reopened Kilgallen's murder case, death, and they no longer consider it an accident, but they consider it a murder. This might be very interesting because right after she died, that mm-hmm. huge file that she had, that Dorothy Kilgallen had compiled on the JFK assassination, disappeared. She said she was going to get to the truth. She was going to find out. She was going to blow this case wide open. And let's look at the facts. And I know that we've talked about this on Darkness Radio a number of times. And, you know, I've even been out to the grassy knoll. And I remember calling you right after that and doing a show with you. And we've discussed this several times. But the thing is, Jack Ruby was involved in the underworld. And he had repeatedly met with Carlos Marcello and Sam Trafficante and Sam Giancana about problems he was having with labor in the entertainment industry. And then he gets into the Dallas Police Department, fully armed, shoots Lee Harvey Oswald 2 days after Oswald is fingered as being the lone assassin in the JFK case. And not coincidentally, Jack Ruby is terminally ill with cancer. Fascinating. Well, after the assassination of President Kennedy, the Federal Bureau of Investigation under J. Edgar Hoover investigated Marcello, and they came to the conclusion that they did not believe Carlos Marcello was a significant organized crime figure and that Marcello earned his living as a tomato salesman and real estate investor. As a result of this investigation, the Warren Commission concluded there was no direct link between Jack Ruby and mafia crime boss Carlos Marcello.
And that's crazy.
And that's history. Isn't that? This has been such a fascinating case. That's what I was saying. This could be a mini series. I mean, so what we're seeing here is, okay, JFK's assassination, and there's various theories about that. But the thing is, though, Dorothy Kilgallen also said that she debunked J. Edgar Hoover's one assassin theory. And that's one of the reasons that the FBI in 2017 reopened the case. So there's been people saying this for a year. And even when I was at the grassy knoll and where they said Lee Harvey Oswald was and where the motorcade and where Kennedy was shot, it just doesn't add up, okay? And I talked to people who actually were there, and they said they were standing at the foot of the grassy knoll, and they heard shots being fired over the fence, which, the fence is still there, it's just a newer version of it. And so that Kilgown was on the trail. She knew that the one assassin theory that Lee Harvey Oswald was nonsense. Secondly, she found the connection not only with the Sinatras, with the mafia, but also the FBI and the CIA, all of which were furious at the way Kennedy handled the Bay of Pigs, and also how Bobby Kennedy had turned on the mafia, which supposedly helped put the Kennedys in power. Then she realizes that Sinatra was using his power in the entertainment industry to destroy Jan and Dean, particularly Dean, although Jan's the one that seemed to pay the highest price, and that she was getting closer and closer to exposing how the FBI somehow was able to cover up the connection between Carlos Marcello, the head of the New Orleans Mafia, and Jack Ruby, who's the one that killed Lee Harvey Oswald. And so she was getting way too close for comfort and hitting a lot of buttons on a lot of extremely powerful and dangerous people.
But here's the thing, right? I mean, if she's onto something and she's making it public that she's going after this story, why, if there was a conspiracy, why would they have given her access to Ruby not once, but twice? Because that seems counterintuitive. If you're trying to keep things under wraps and control the narrative.
That is, that's part of why she was such a great journalist. And perhaps she was able to pull some strings to get in. And I think she was kind of keeping it quiet at first about what she was doing to see Jack Ruby. She described him as, you know, he tried to smile, but it looked like a fake smile. His hand shook when she shook his hand. I mean, her descriptions, the few that have survived. But the thing is, Dave, I'll bet dollars to donuts that file that she had, which has probably been burned or it's in, you know, some archive next to the Lost Ark somewhere. I bet it does lay out everything that was behind the assassination of President John F. Kennedy.
And this all stems, right, crazily enough, from this abduction of Frank Sinatra Jr. This weird tie to all of this. Now, as you're examining it, does it look a little too set up, and especially with the way criminals are treated after the case? I mean, this is a major celebrity, a federal crime, and it just seemed more like a slap on the wrist to everybody involved.
Well, when you look at the personality profile of Barry Keenan and Joe Amsler, these were pretty room temperature IQ individuals, and they were just stupid and clumsy. And I would like to think, well, not that I would like to think, but I would logically conclude that they were too stupid for the mob to use. And I don't think that Frank Sinatra would have been so stupid as to put his son through something like this. And here's why I say that. In June 27th, 1964, a Catholic priest who was the chaplain at the Springfield prison where Keenan and Amsler were held, mailed a letter to Frank and Mrs. Sinatra. And he said, "I've become very well acquainted personally with Mr. Barry Keenan and Mr. Joe Amsler. I have spoken with both of these men on numerous occasions about the true Catholic approach to the crime of kidnapping your son. I'm not speaking officially, but it was evident that Barry and Joe are basically good men and they would try to make amends to the Sinatras. No doubt you did experience a great deal of suffering and emotional anxiety during the kidnapping, as well as perhaps some embarrassment during the trial. This is understanding, and Barry and Joe have often have often expressed their sorrow and regret." Well, the Sinatras certainly notified J. Edgar Hoover about this, and a month later, Frank Sr. wrote a letter back to Father Schmidt. "Dear Father Schmidt, Mrs. Sinatra and I were disturbed by your letter of June 27, 1964, written on behalf of Barry Keenan and Joseph Amsler. Since you have had no prior relationship to the Sinatra family, we assume that it was not the purpose of your letter to give us religious guidance. Accordingly, there could be only two possible purposes for your letter. One, a request that we forgive Keenan and Amsler, and or two, that we take some action to express our forgiveness in order to alleviate the punishment the court has imposed upon them. It requires more than expressions of regret to a chaplain or to others at your medical center to atone for sins. Then Sinatra sent that with the original letter to J. Edgar Hoover. In his letter to Hoover, "Dear Edgar, I'm not sending you this correspondence for any official reaction, but thought that you would find the correspondence interesting, particularly insofar as it reflects my own attitude with respect to what has happened. I'd like to express my deep appreciation and thanks for the excellent work of the FBI in securing the safe return of my son, in solving the crime, and the tremendous amount of work I know they did in assisting the Department of Justice." And J. Edgar Hoover wrote back, "Dear Frank, I can certainly understand your concern in this matter and appreciate your interest in sending me this correspondence. I also want to thank you for your very kind comments regarding our participation in the investigation relating to your son's kidnapping. The demand of the hour in America is for jurors with conscience, judges with courage, and prisons which are neither country clubs or health resorts. It is not the criminals, actual or potential, that need a neuropathic hospital. It is the people who slobber over them in an effort to find excuses for their crime."
Yeah, he ain't wrong, that's for sure.
J. Edgar Hoover is one of the most polarizing figures in American history. Presidents were intimidated by him. He ruthlessly controlled the Federal Bureau of Investigation for years. It was believed to be a closeted homosexual, and his number two in charge at the FBI, was it Mr. Tolles, was his partner. In fact, at J. Edgar Hoover's funeral, which was full military style, when the flag was folded, they gave Mr. Tolles the flag that you normally would do for a spouse. And the shadow of J. Edgar Hoover still looms, I think, in many respects over. I find it anomalous, if not even insulting, that the FBI headquarters is known as the J. Edgar Hoover Building, because this is a man who basically was a mob boss. He just did it with the authority of the law. And that's my personal opinion. But I think history would prove me right.
You know, there was so much mockery made of the abduction case. I mean, even there's an episode of The Monkees where they're trying to become famous, and the agent that they've procured, who turns out to be the agent of another band, ends up telling them, "Hey, the big trend is getting abducted. We're going to get you kidnapped," and you know, they go through this whole rigmarole. So it was basically kind of looked at as a joke. How did Frank Jr. respond after all of this? You know, was it hard to reestablish or get that career rolling again?
I think for the early and mid 60s, it was very difficult for him. Also, even though he was a music personality, a singing star, let's face it, this was the 1960s, and his style of music was not, you know, for 19 and 20 year olds. So here he is, 19 and 20, and he's basically singing big band era. Even Jan and Dean, they started the surf music and the pop. I mean, think about it. There was Jan and Dean. There were the Surfaris. There were then, of course, the Beach Boys eclipsed Jan and Dean. And then by the mid 60s, the Beatles and the Rolling Stones started taking rock and roll and modern music in a much different direction. And so Frank Sinatra Jr.'s singing career never really went is anywhere near as far as possibly it could have. Maybe he should have adapted his sound. I know Nancy Sinatra, his sister, scored some big hits. She actually, I think she sang one of the James Bond themes, "You Only Live Twice," I think.
Yeah,
I think that's right. She did. And "Those Boots Are Made for Walking," I mean, something like that. But as far as Frank Sinatra Jr., the last time I remember seeing him was in an episode of The Sopranos where he played himself.
Right. And that was shortly before he had to face Tim and I and get that intimidated feeling of being kidnapped again. Tim, we got to dig that picture up and put it out again. That was he has just got this, I don't even know, this stunned kind of almost afraid look in his eyes standing between Tim and I. It's just a great picture.
You know, in a lot of ways, I mean, Frank Sinatra Jr. had it all. He had the Hollywood parents. But on the other hand, his father was also one of the most famous people on the planet. And growing up in that shadow, yeah, he had all the connections, but he wasn't his father. And, you know, I don't want to say that I feel sorry for him, but I can certainly see that it was very frustrating for him to establish himself. And it also makes a lot of logical sense that the media and certainly the defense in this case would try to turn around and say it's a hoax. You know, his career is flagging. So obviously this is a major publicity stunt and they're doing everything they can. And then, you know, saying that he didn't cry out when they're at a police roadblock, he didn't try to get away. They were portraying him as a wimp. I mean, this guy was only 19 years old. He was a kid, and this definitely damaged his public image. And, you know, his father absolutely loved him, but I don't know what the dynamic was between them. From my understanding is Frank Sinatra Sr. was not around a lot when Frank Sinatra Jr. was growing up, because he himself was on the road and being old Blue Eyes.
Yeah, there had to be that had to be a hard umbrella to be under, right? And the thing is, if I remember correctly, Sinatra himself would say Jr. had a better voice than he did, but he just didn't have the same soul behind the songs. I think that's why he never exploded as much as his father did. Plus, he was old-fashioned and didn't like that drug music. If I remember him telling Tim in the concert we saw him in, you know, he wasn't part of that 60s culture. It was like Frank Sinatra Jr. was born too late for what he was best suited to do.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. Or maybe he should have just gone into acting or something when he was younger. But, you know, he benefited from the family and both suffered as the result of the times and the changing music. The sad thing with Jan and Dean is that he died, I believe, back in 2004. He had to live with brain damage and paralysis for most of his life. And even though he did go on a brief tour with Dean Torrance, did a Jan and Dean tour, their music career really tanked. Dean Torrance actually sang in the Beach Boys song Barbara Ann. He's the lead singer, Barbara Ann. That's him. With I didn't realize that. I thought it was Mike Love. You know, he did a number of things because he felt that his sound blended with the Beach Boys. But his music career never really took off after the demise of Jan and Dean. So there was a lot of tragedy that all stemmed from this. And, you know, the really sad part is that Dean Torrance didn't have the wherewithal to realize that if somebody comes and asks you, give me $1,200 so I can go kidnap the son of the famous singer in the world, that you should say no.
Yeah, that just seems like it should be common sense. And as much as I love Tim, if he came to me and he's like, Dave, hey, I need $1,200. I'm going to go kidnap Snoop Dogg's kid. Sure, we'd share a laugh about it, but I wouldn't give him the $1,200.
Absolutely. And by doing that, and it shows how dumb these guys, you go snag Frank Sinatra Jr. All right. So not only are you ticking off one of the most powerful figures in entertainment, that immediately brings in the Kennedy family, the FBI, and the mob. Yeah, that's brilliant.
Yeah, you've got to be insane to have made this choice. And I can't believe that people, you know, that he did this. I can't. There's just such a travesty all the way around when you look at the fact that, you know, people knew about this. I'm sure that, you know, Dean was not the only one that they talked to about this, and that nobody came forward when this happened to say, hey, I might know a guy. Right.
That's
so bizarre.
Yeah. You know, people do things for publicity stunts. But kidnapping's a pretty serious thing. And to the day he died, from what I understand, Frank Sinatra Jr. said that, no, I did not do this. I understand there is a movie in production right now about the kidnapping. We've seen other ones, and in Hollywood, is they tend to redo various stories over and over. So I'm quite excited to see the take this time. I'd like to see them do basically what we did today, Dave. Take the whole thing, not just the kidnapping, but the fallout, what happened to Jan and Dean, what happened to the journalists, Killigan, just the whole kahuna. And you don't have to say this is what happened, but at least get the audience thinking this could be what happened. It's very disturbing when you see the FBI claiming that the boss of the New Orleans mob is merely a tomato salesman and real estate investor.
Yeah, it definitely makes you question how deep the roots of corruption really go.
Well, one of the only things that Lee Harvey Oswald said on camera, he looked right at one of the news cameras and said, "I'm a patsy." In other words, they're sacrificing me for this. I'm a patsy. And then what? A day later, 2 days later, Jack Ruby shoots him at point blank range. How do you get into the Dallas Police Department armed and get close enough to the man under arrest for assassinating the president of the United States?
Well, that part, I you know what? I got to be honest. That part I get, because it was a different time. It was a different era. And you knew somebody, you recognized him. This was an area that people were friendly with one another. And there are looky-loos. Look, when Dillinger was assassinated, killed out in front of the Biograph Theater, people were dipping their handkerchiefs in his blood. People loved the salacious nature of crime, and to have a prominent figure in town, even though he was, strip club owner and kind of a ne'er-do-well, he's still well-known, and probably many of the police officers frequented his establishment. So seeing him there wouldn't have been a surprise. The gun is a surprise. So that aspect of it, I'm not as blown away by. But I will tell you, when Tim and I did a show years ago where we talked with Lee Harvey Oswald's lover, Judith Very Baker. And, I'd always thought, boy, they're really blowing this into some kind of crazy conspiracy. But talking to her, sitting down face to face with her, and Tim, I think you can attest to this, the sincerity, the depth she was able to take you into this story and give you a different perspective. I walked away believing Lee Harvey Oswald had nothing to do with the assassination and truly was a patsy. Tim, how did you feel after talking with Judith?
I think you and I came from different perspectives. You believe that she had something to do with them. I believe that she thinks she had something to do with them. I don't know that she was. I don't know. We have differing perspectives on it.
Well, due to the fact that they both worked for, Dr. Mary Monkey, lab.
Yeah, they did.
They were both a part of it, and there was a connection. It's not a hard stretch for me, and that she had she had so much documentation, Mark. She came in with, I was expecting just some nutbag to come in, but she might have an interesting story. She had this huge volume of information, and it was like a big scrapbook, but with time cards with Lee Harvey Oswald and her from the lab and all of these different storylines and aspects, and then things she pointed out here, for a guy who was supposedly a traitor to his country, when he was arrested, he was wearing his Marine ring. And for a man who denounced his country, why would you still be wearing your military ring? There was that aspect of it. The fact that he came forward and said to the government, hey, I got wind that there's going to be an assassination attempt on Kennedy, and then came to Judith afterwards basically and said, oh, man, I'm screwed. I'm a dead man. He knew that when he revealed it, and his military connections took it a different way, he knew that he was about to be set up. So to me, I don't know. To me, it resonated. And I don't know if it was just because I got to sit there and look into her eyes that it's easier to buy into. But there's just too much to say that it's anything but a conspiracy.
I read a book some years ago by Jimmy Fratiani, that his nickname was Jimmy the Weasel. And at that time, he was the highest ranking mafia official to ever turn state's evidence and go on witness protection. And he said that the thought that Lee Harvey Oswald was acting alone is idiotic. And he said that there was a Corsican hit team that was brought in, and that they were sheltered in a safe house in Dallas, and that it was a CIA mafia FBI alliance for the reasons that, you know, they all had a reason to get rid of them. Certainly Cuba going the way that it was. And the mafia lost a lot of money when Cuba went communist. They lost all the casinos, all the hotels. The FBI did not like J. Edgar Hoover, did not like the Kennedys. They didn't like Bobby Kennedy turning on the mafia. And so this is what Jimmy the Weasel said. I mean, he just came out and said the idea. And he said, and look, he goes, Jimmy Hoffa, he goes, he pissed off the Detroit mob and they clipped him. Okay. I mean, he was just like really, really straightforward about that.
Amazing stuff. Mark, you're the guy. When we throw to you, you always come in with the truth and the story and the history. Thank you for all the work and research you did for us on this one. It's amazing.
Well, thank you, Dave. And I've got some good news. I've got my next book. Book number 3 is coming out this October. Yeah, I hope to be back on Darkness Radio to talk about it. It's got some really cutting edge concepts, and it's been endorsed by the top near-death experience in survival of consciousness scientists in the world.
Fantastic. Let me know when the book is out. We want to break it and get you on the air here and have you be a part of the program. Mark, it's always a pleasure, my friend. Stay safe. And how can people find you if they want to get personal readings, mediumship readings, or copies of your books? What's the best route?
Please visit my website, evidenceofeternity.com, which is the same as my last book, Evidence of Eternity. And if you mention Darkness Radio, you have to mention Darkness Radio, you will qualify for a reduced fee reading. And I invite everyone to sign up for my newsletter to find out when I'm going to be on Darkness Radio again and other appearances. Dave, Tim, I want to thank you, and I want to especially thank the Army of Darkness. You guys are loyal to this show for good reason, and thank you to each and every one of you.
Stay safe, my friend, and we will be in touch again soon. All right, kids, it's time to kick open those case files. Oh, I love this part of the show. It's time now for Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals.
It's Crayon News story time.
What happened with this dude, Christ Bearer? I heard he cut his penis off and then jumped off a balcony.
Suspect pulls gun from butt, shoots twice at Denver police.
What is your emergency?
I need help.
And what's the problem?
I'm too high.
You're too high?
Yeah.
I always love having Mark Anthony on the show. He brings such fun stories, weird tales. Great to have him on. Hope you guys enjoyed him as well. We've got some other interesting topics and guests coming up over the next month here. So keep them coming, folks. If you have found a true crime book or story or something you think you'd like us to investigate on the show, email me, dave@darknessradio.com. Tim, before we get truly started into Dumb Crimes, Stupid Criminals, I'm being inundated with these stories, not from our listeners, just because I've got a true crime kind of tickler in my news feed so that I'm always looking for interesting stories.
Okay.
One that I'm finding heartbreaking, and listen, I know people are under a lot of stress during the COVID crisis, losing their jobs, losing mass amounts of income, trying to figure out how to take care of their family, but all too many stories, and I'm just going to read this headline, all too many stories are coming across like this. Ohio mom who reported son age 6 missing is now accused of murdering him and throwing his body in the river.
Oh,
this is not a dumb crime, stupid criminal.
Right.
But I'm getting on average 5 to 10 stories a day of parents murdering their children.
Oof.
I'm going to ask, and I mean this wholeheartedly, I understand we have a huge audience out there. I understand you're under a lot of pressure, under a lot of stress. if you are at a point in your life that you feel the best thing to do is to murder your children because you cannot take care of them, please email me, dave@darknessradio.com. I will be happy to take parental rights and raise your children as my own. And that's coming from a guy with a house full of kids, but they will be treated with love, kindness, and compassion. And you will be spoken about kindly for making a better choice than to end their lives. Sometimes we find ourselves in predicaments in life that we cannot get out of, or we feel trapped by, or we feel as though we're in a hole that's slowly being covered up. And instead of failing in front of those that we love, people choose to take those people out. If you are at that point, please don't end the life of your children. I'm not kidding you. I will gladly adopt your children. dave@darknessradio.com. You can call my Voices from Beyond voicemail, 651-300-4977. Leave your number. I will not report it to the police. I will not report it to law enforcement. We will contact an attorney and draw papers, and I will adopt your children. I don't care how many people across the United States or around the world are in that position. I will take them all. All right? Don't make that choice. Please do not make that choice. That's all I'm asking. Now let's lighten things up and have a little fun, shall we, Tim?
All right.
This is a weird transition, but runaway father tries to cheat a paternity test and avoid $60,000 in child maintenance payments by getting his brother to take his paternity test for him. Not a very bright man, Tim. Yeah, not very bright at all. A reluctant dad who was challenged to take a DNA paternity test thought he had hatched the perfect escape plan when he persuaded his teenage brother to act as a stand-in. But the twisted plot backfired alarmingly when the results came back to show that the man who took the test was not the dad, but was closely related to the baby. Perplexed, the child's mother queried the results and was shown a picture of the young man who attended the doctor's surgery for the test. She responded by saying that he looked like a younger version of her ex, and further inquiries revealed that it was her ex's younger brother, who she had never met. Earlier this week, the two brothers, Christian Robinson, 26, and Army Private Samuel Robinson, now 20, admitted jointly committing fraud by false representation at Leicester Crown Court. Both were spared jail for the offense, which prosecutor Priya Bakshi said could have cost the baby's mother $60,000 in maintenance, with Christian giving a suspended sentence and brother Samuel a conditional discharge. The court heard that Christian had been in a relationship with the woman when she became pregnant in 2017, but the split up happened just before the birth in January of 2018. In February, she had made a child maintenance application naming Christian as the father. He denied it and asked for a DNA test. But when the test was due, he sent along his 17-year-old brother Sam, then in training to become a soldier. Prosecutor Priya Bakshi told the court that the scam could have cost the baby's mother more than $60,000 in maintenance. In mitigation, the court was told that Christian deeply regretted his actions in leading his younger brother into trouble. He was now on benefits and contributing towards the $5,500 in child maintenance arrears he had already racked up. The court heard that Samuel was now a lance corporal and that his promising army career hung in the balance. Judge Timothy Spencer, QC, told Christian that his actions had been deeply shameful and a serious deceit, adding, "The child maintenance system depends to a large extent on the trust of people who rightly become the subject of it. Being decent and honest with the system, what do? You tried to cheat it." He told the young man that he was in the last chance saloon from the courts due to the previous conviction for perverting justice when he gave false details following a motoring offense back in 2015. But handing down an 18-month sentence suspended for 2 years, he added, "I'm satisfied your remorse and shame are wholly genuine. You're hard-pressed for money and on benefits, but are now paying something towards the shortfall of child maintenance. I expect you to get a job to pay your dues. I accept your help in many ways was dealt you a raw deal and frustrated your ambitions to work in sports coaching." Turning to Samuel, the judge gave what he called an exceptional sentence, a 6-month conditional discharge. He said, what a career you have forged with all that promise ahead of you, and now you're in Crown Court. I'm told by your troop commander you're an exceptional soldier, and I'm going to pass an exceptional sentence in your case. He added, you were placed in an invidious position by an elder brother who you no doubt looked up to, asking for a brotherly favor. You couldn't have realized the consequences of what he was asking, and he exploited your naivete. This is your only brush with the law, and I'm confident the court won't see you again. I want to see you continue to flourish in the army and not damage your prospects. This country needs exceptional soldiers like you, and this offense is nowhere near the scale where the army should consider damaging your career. It is their decision, but I appeal to them to allow you to continue. Wow. Well, talk about conditional discharge. The one guy should have thought of that before he had sex with the woman. Huh?
Yeah.
Conditional discharge? Yeah. See what I did there? What the hell? Yeah. What bonehead doesn't realize DNA is going to attach you through your brother? Oh, my God. This is not a light story either, Tim, but it's one that we need to cover. Lawrence Anderson, age 42, confessed to fatally stabbing his neighbor on February 9th, then returning home and killing his uncle and four-year-old girl, the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation said in a statement. Court documents obtained by the Oklahoman said Anderson, who removed his neighbor's heart and attempted to feed it to his aunt and uncle. He cooked the heart with potatoes to feed his family to release the demons, an OSBI agent wrote in a request for a search warrant, according to the Oklahoman. Court records show that Lawrence faces three charges of first-degree murder in the deaths of 41-year-old Andrea Lynn Blankenship, 67-year-old Leon Pye, and 4-year-old Chaos Yates. Lawrence also faces one charge of assault and battery with a deadly weapon, one charge of maiming. Prosecutors have said the death penalty is absolutely on the table for Lawrence, according to the local NBC affiliate KFOR. Lawrence was also accused of stabbing his aunt Daisy Pye in both eyes during the attack. She survived and attended a court hearing for Lawrence on Tuesday wearing sunglasses. The attack has stoked controversy in Oklahoma since Anderson has been released from prison on a commuted sentence just 3 weeks before the alleged stabbing spree. Court records show that Lawrence had been given several lengthy prison sentences in the past, mainly for drug convictions. Court documents also show that Lawrence has not yet made a plea in his triple homicide charges, nor is it clear whether he has been assigned a lawyer. His next hearing scheduled for April 1st. That's no joke, and neither is Dave Schrader, Tim Dennis, defense attorneys at law. Our numbers are turned off to this knucklehead. Triple murder suspect told police he killed his neighbor and tried to feed his family her heart to release the demons.
That's
utterly insane.
Very, very insane, Dave. I think that might be probably the plea that was insane to take the case.
Mm. Yeah. All right, here you go, Tim. Arizona man is accused of faking his own kidnapping to evade work. Police in Coolidge, Arizona arrested a man who claimed he had been kidnapped to get out of work. The Casa Grande Dispatch reported at around 5:25 p.m. on February 10th that police say they found the 19-year-old Brandon Souls near a water tower with his hands bound behind his back and a bandana stuffed in his mouth. Souls told police he was kidnapped by two masked men. He says the men knocked him unconscious and drove him around in a vehicle before leaving him by a water tower. He claims both men were bald, wearing glasses, and had goatees, speaking with a Minnesota accent. Wait, what?
Huh?
That part I'm joking about. Coolidge detectives conducted an investigation that found no evidence that a kidnapping or assault had occurred. Officers say when they looked at surveillance video to corroborate his story of him being hit over the head and stuffed in his car in front of his home, they saw no signs of this story to be true. He also alleged the kidnapping occurred because of a large amount of money his father had hidden around town, which was also fabricated. He was arrested February 17th for false reporting to police. Officer says Sewells admitted that he made up the story as an excuse to get out of work during an interview. Coolidge police say Sewells was fired from his job at the tire factory, Tim. They're not putting up with that shit and shenanigans. Wow. Wow. Had he just known about this next guy, he might have been able to plan his routine a little better, Tim. Are you ready for this?
I'm ready.
Landlord who evicted tenants did so by tying them up at gunpoint and dumping them in a snowy cemetery. He's been charged with kidnapping, according to police. That's dramatic. Trying to get somebody out of your apartment. A landlord in upstate New York is accused of going to the extreme and illegal lengths to evict tenants during the COVID-19 pandemic. Sean Douglas, 48, had been charged with kidnapping after he allegedly forced two tenants into a car at gunpoint and left them in a snow-covered cemetery in the pre-dawn hours of a Sunday morning. The Albany Times-Union reported he allegedly used zip ties and tape to tie up a 32-year-old man and 21-year-old female and then covered their heads with pillowcases. The defendant had become increasingly frustrated by the moratorium on evictions put in place due to the COVID-19 pandemic. The report said the current restrictions run until May. Taking matters into his own hands, police say Douglas and possibly two accomplices broke into the Grandview Terrace residence he's owned since 2006 and held the two tenants at gunpoint. After the man and woman were bound, Douglas allegedly loaded them into what they told police was a Dodge Durango, the Times Union reported. With the help of the two other unidentified suspects, they drove the man and woman to a motel that the victims told police may have been in Colony. From there, they were driven to the isolated cemetery in Ghent, a rural town in Columbia County, about 35 miles southeast of Albany. The identities of the two tenants have not quite been reported. The two other suspects have not been named either. According to a police report cited by the newspaper, the male victim was punched and kicked by Douglas and the other two suspects before being tied up. Both victims still had their hands bound when they were dumped in the snowy graveyard, approximately 35 miles outside of Albany. And when I laugh, I'm not laughing at the monstrosity of this. I'm still stunned week after week by how stupid people are. No, not the two that got evicted, but that this guy thought this is the way to handle it.
Yeah.
Additionally, the police report noted that because the two victims were left in below freezing wintry conditions with their hands still bound, Douglas and his accomplices exposed them to a risk of serious physical injury. Douglas was taken into custody Monday afternoon, per the Times Union. He was arraigned on charges of second-degree kidnapping, being held at Albany County Jail. Tim, you've kidnapped two of your tenants, beat the shit out of one of them, mm-hmm. hog-tied them, covered them with pillowcases, drove them out 35 miles away from home, dropped them off, bound and gagged and covered in a snowy cemetery in freezing weather. What is your bond? How much do you think?
Oh, God, I always lose at this game. I'm going to go now. See, my spidey sense says go between $10,000 and $20,000, Dave. How close am I?
You know what? For once, your spidey sense is in the right direction. It's only $50,000, apparently, to kidnap people, bind and gag them and leave them out in the middle of nowhere.
That's it.
So. Got an extra 50 grand laying around and a couple of people pissing you off. Just putting it out there, Tim.
Huh. All right.
What the hell? 50 grand? 25 grand a person?
Huh. That seems incredibly cheap. I don't know why.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so, too.
Yeah.
Police records show that Douglas has been arrested in the past and charged with assault and violating a restraining order. Gunpoint.
Yeah.
Beat them, tied them, duct taped them. Unbelievable. Wow. All right, here we go. World's unluckiest burglars have been arrested, Tim. As pocket dials go, it was a fairly costly one. Two suspected burglars have been arrested after accidentally phoning the police on themselves. Staffordshire police confirmed that they arrested a 49-year-old and a 42-year-old after receiving a call from one of them, who appeared to have unwittingly sat on his phone. Officers said they listened to the call as the men carried out the burglary and could even hear their colleagues arrive to make the arrests. I think we've just arrested the world's unluckiest burglars, said it's C-H space I-N-S-P. That's Chief Inspector John Owen, Tim, but I read it as Chinsp John Owen. Police said that they arrested the two men in Middleport area of Stoke-on-Trent on suspicion of burglary after receiving the suspicious call on Wednesday evening. They were still in custody as of Thursday morning. Poking fun at the unlucky pair, Owen included an image of Marv, the hapless burglar from the Home Alone film series in a Twitter post on Wednesday evening. He says, I think we've just arrested the world's unluckiest burglars. Whilst committing a burglary, one of the bungling burglars accidentally sat on his phone dialing 999. We receive a call detailing all of their antics up to the point of hearing our patrols actually arrive to arrest them. It is not the first time a set of robbers has managed to shop themselves within in judiciously placed rear end. In 2013, a pair who were breaking into a car in Fresno, California, managed to call police on themselves as well. The call handler on duty was able to track them down as Nathan Tekelmeriam and Carson Reinhart spent about half an hour discussing their plans. The pair were eventually arrested. This stuff just doesn't happen where a crime is captured from beginning to end, said Sergeant Jamie Rios. The 911 call was still open at the time of the arrests, and the officer took the phone and ended the call himself. While 25-year-old Callum Tumility managed not to call the police on himself when he broke into Cambio's first school near Blythe in Northumberland to steal a load of laptops, his mother was less obliging. Tumility left his phone behind at the crime scene and was caught after his mother called to try to track him down and ask the person who answered if Callum was there. Officers on the scene were quickly able to identify and track down the guilty party. According to Newcastle's Chronicle newspaper, Tumility was later sentenced to 26 weeks in prison after pleading guilty to several charges. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
You go in to steal a bunch of stuff, set your cell phone down, leave, and leave your cell phone there. Jeez. Tim, have you ever been in a cockfight?
Once in college, Dave, it involved a lot of beer and a lot of pride.
I'm not talking about your experimental times, Tim.
No. Okay.
A rooster kills an Indian man during a banned cockfight. That's right, man. This is a case of swift justice, swift justice, swift justice. Man was killed by a rooster with a blade tied to its leg during an illegal cockfight in southern India. Police said bringing focus to practice that continues in some Indian states despite a decades-old ban. The rooster, with a 3-inch knife tied to its leg, fluttered in panic and slashed its owner, 45-year-old Thangula Satish, in his groin last week. Oh! Imagine that. You're sitting there, you're holding your cock, and it's got a 3-inch blade attached to it.
Yep.
And in the ultimate twist of irony, your cock cuts your groin.
Yeah, I've been there, done that. That was part of that thing in college,
what?
Dave. Yeah.
The incident occurred in Lathurner Village of Telangana State. They got nothing. According to Javine, Satish was injured when he prepared the rooster for a fight. Satish was hit by the rooster's knife in his groin and immediately began bleeding heavily, the officer said, adding that the man died on the way to the hospital. Good God. But, you know, I would you want that in your obituary? How did Tim die? His cock attacked him.
Actually,
would you want that?
Yeah.
his cock attacked him. Or how about his cock slipped him a cold 3 inches?
That might be a little embarrassing. Yeah.
Well, that one might be embarrassing.
Yeah.
Javen said police filed a case and were looking for more than a dozen people involved in organizing the cockfight. If proved guilty, the organizers can be jailed for just up to 2 years. Cockfights are common in the southern Indian states of Telangana, Andhra Pradesh, Tamil Nadu, and Karnataka. Despite a countrywide ban imposed in 1960, animal rights activists have long been calling to control the illegal practice, which is mainly organized as part of local Hindu festivals, usually attended by hundreds of people, though the crowd sometimes swelled to thousands. The cockfights are often held under the watch of powerful local politicians and involve large sums of betting money. Last year, a man was killed when the blade attached to his bird's leg hit him in the neck during a cockfight in Andhra Pradesh. In 2010, a rooster killed its owner by slashing his jugular vein in West Bengal. According to police, the rooster involved in last week's incident was among many other roosters prepared for the cockfight betting festival in Lanthur Village. As the practice goes, a knife, a blade, or other sharp-edged weapon is tied to the leg of a bird to harm its rival. Such fights continue until one contestant is either dead or flees and the other rooster is declared the winner. Javine said that the rooster was brought to the police station before being taken to a local poultry farm We may need to produce it before the court, he said. Images of the rooster tied with a rope and pecking on grains at the police station were widely viewed on social media. Unbelievable.
Mm.
Not the way to go. You don't want to go death by cock, Tim.
Well, some people may, but not me. No,
Nobody wants to go death by cock. Yeah, I wonder if they ended up cooking and eating them afterwards. Somebody might have gobbled the cock down after the whole thing was said and done in the court system.
Well, again, Dave, some people may, but not me.
No. You know, I actually had rooster when we were in France. They serve it there.
Yeah?
Yeah, you could eat it. And tastes like chicken.
Really? I would have never thought.
It really does. It tastes like chicken. I was surprised. I thought that was just an old wives' tale. Everything tastes like chicken.
Well,
here's my favorite story that came out this week, Tim. Uh-huh. You know, sometimes you're just so committed to your job, you got to continue your job no matter what, right?
Yeah.
Well, last thing any patient needs is a multitasking doctor, or is it? Dr. Scott Green found himself in the middle of surgery at the start of his traffic trial via video conference last Thursday, Tim. The startling image of Green decked out in scrubs and evidently standing in an operating room immediately caught the attention of a California courtroom clerk, reported the Sacramento Bee. Hello, Mr. Green. Hi, are you available for trial? Asked the clerk as the cop involved in the case appeared startled. It kind of looks like you're in an operating room right now. Without missing a beat, Green admitted he was with a patient. Yes, I'm available for trial, said the doctor. Go right ahead. The February 25th video conference collage captured by the Sacramento Bee shows Dr. Scott Green for his virtual trial, a Sacramento court commissioner, and the police officer involved in the case. The clerk noted that the proceedings were being live streamed, as all traffic trials are open to the public. Green said he understood and appeared to resume surgery while waiting for the court commissioner to commence the hearing.
Jeez.
Soon after, Sacramento Superior Court Commissioner Gary Link appeared on the video feed. When Link finally appeared, he asked Green what he was doing. I have another surgeon right here who's doing the surgery with me, so I can stand here and allow them to do the surgery also, explained Green. Link then halted the proceedings, stating that the performing surgery during a trial probably wasn't a good idea. I wonder if this guy was caught for distracted driving.
I bet he was. Yeah.
He then told Green he would reschedule for when you're not actively involved or participating in surgery and needing to attend to the needs of a patient. Now, the Medical Board of California is planning to probe the incident, according to the Bee. The board noted that it expects physicians to follow the standard of care when treating their patients.
Well, but here's the deal, though.
What?
I mean, seriously, think about everything that, especially in these times, everything that doctors and nurses have to do, they're overloaded as it is. And when COVID came along, you had a lot of layoffs, first of all, because essentially every essential doctor nurse was put on COVID duty.
Right.
And then all specialties kind of went by the wayside. Mm. So when surgeons started coming back to do, you know, what they call elective surgeries, or what were essentially elective surgeries, they got right. slammed. So, you know, they weren't doing just a normal workload. They were hit with an overabundance of procedures to do in a day. So this guy really doesn't have a time down the road to do a court date.
But do you do live surgery during your court date? It just seems like that's a bad choice. I think the guy was doing it as posturing, showing them, look, I'm a very busy surgeon. And, you know, I think he was looking for leniency on the court. First of all, if you're a well-respected surgeon, pay the $100 fine. Don't be an ass. And second of all, you know, I don't see a world where I'm comfortable as the patient allowing my doctor to have a trial during my surgery.
The patient was not aware that they were
right
on display. Second, I know plenty of, believe it or not, I know plenty of doctors and surgeons who are that absent-minded that they would forget about something like that. Like their days meld into days. And all of a sudden they're reminded by a scheduler that, hey, by the way, you have this court date that's coming up today. And they go, oh, shoot. Yeah, I forgot all about it. Oh, I have the option to zoom in. Just zoom me in. I'll just do it here while I'm doing this. And they just don't, they put it that low on their priority list. while they're doing other things. So I can totally believe a surgeon is zooming in while they're working on a patient.
What a weird world. Well, that's it this week, folks. Thanks for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed Mark Anthony and Dumb Crimes, Stupid Criminals as much as we enjoyed bringing it to you. We will be back again next week with more of the best in true crime talk radio. Remember, tomorrow and Thursday, we've got more editions of the best in paranormal talk radio, Darkness Radio, and then Thursday night live. There's only a few episodes left, Tim. I think three episodes left. Maybe four of the Holzer Files. Thursday night live, we have got our Holzer's Ghosts episode. You can watch it live stream on Darkness Radio's YouTube page or on Darkness Radio's Facebook page or on my personal Facebook page. And then it will be made available. The audio is made available on Friday for those of you that are subscribers to the podcast. So that way you can check in and listen. That's it for today. I'm Dave. That's Tim. You've been listening to the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday.